question in our lives is not whether or not we will experience suffering, but when suffering comes into my life, will I build a city? Will I build a fortress? Will I build a protection against it? Or will I embrace it?
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Suffering is often caused by external circumstances, but it always, always has an internal reality. We suffer so much internally from things that happen outside of ourselves and from the issues that we deal with inside of ourselves, from the beliefs that we hold. Jack, why is suffering such a huge part of all of our lives? At least at some point in our lives, we go through such difficulty, such loss, such pain. Why does God bring this in?
That's sort of the $60 million question. You know, if we actually face the question, why does God do it that way? I don't know that the Bible ever really gives us an answer. I can answer a sort of slightly different question, and that is God behind it? Is it a part of God's purposes? Is it productive? Is it an important and valuable thing in our lives? I think the Bible would say clearly yes, and we can talk about that. But if we ask the question behind that of, well, why would God do it that way? Why would God bless us and do all this work in our lives constructively through such a painful and awful and agonizing process? To that answer, to that question, I don't think the Bible offers an answer. The closest thing it does to offer an answer to that question is the book of Job. And to that, he basically poses a rhetorical question to Job. Job, do I know what I'm doing or don't I? And Job decides, yes, you do. It's clear that you do know what you're doing. I can't really object to your using the tools that you've decided in your wisdom to use because you know what you're doing. But I think that's as close to an answer as we get to that.
That's not very satisfying to hear that, is it?
Okay, ask me again. I'll give you a different answer.
Give me a better answer than that, Jack. I don't like that one. Well, I just think about, you know, when you said that, it just kind of falls flat in some way because, I work with a lot of people, and I'm certain you do, that come into my office and just are hit, it seems like, every week by a bulldozer. It is awesome to me. I'm almost embarrassed by my life in comparison sometimes. I cannot believe the tragedies that lots of times, like hurricanes out of the north, they didn't expect it, they didn't contribute to it, it just came to them.
Right.
And there's lots of things that we create for ourselves, but we don't create a tornado coming to our house and coming to it every week.
Right. Well, and I'm sure you in the counseling office in a situation like that feel very much like the counselors of Job in the book of Job. You know,
I'm a better counselor than them. Thanks, Jack.
No, but what I'm saying is that I really identify with them for the very reason that you're suggesting, is that by contrast, my life seems so smooth. And you're tempted, therefore, to want to find some explanation. Why is their life... And why are they experiencing such tragic circumstances? And by comparison, my life is so smooth. It's very tempting to look for an answer to that, that's somehow located in them. There's something about you that's bringing this on you. And that's what the counselors in the book of Job succumb to, is that they're just insisting with Job, you know, if you'd just be honest with yourself, there's some sin in you that would explain the suffering that's going on. And one of the agendas of the book of Job is to refute that and to basically say, no, that's not the right answer. That's not the explanation. Job is an utterly upright and righteous man, more righteous than anyone around him, and he's suffering the most. So we can't correlate suffering with sin and evil in our lives. It just doesn't work that way. Something else is going on. And what is that something else? Well, that something else is God in His wisdom taking our lives the way He wants to take our lives for purposes that go way beyond anything that we can even comprehend.
And I think we really have to stay with that. It's way beyond what we can comprehend. Lots of times I just have to say to people, I don't get why, other than I know that God is good, I know He's real, I know that He has a plan, I know that He's creating something. I don't get it. I don't see it. I don't understand exactly or even close to what that is. But I just stand on that goodness of God. And that's it.
Right.
That's what I have.
Right.
And just stand by and support people who are hurting so terribly.
Right.
But there's no answer. There's nothing to tell people. There's nothing to make it better except to support and to love them and be there and to hear it.
Right. I think the important thing to understand, I mean, you started by saying that answer just falls flat, and I understand what you're saying. It does. Until we come to see what a vital issue it is, what I do with the suffering in my life.
But it falls flat to people who don't get that yet, Jack.
Right, yeah, exactly.
I could have all the understanding in the world of my own suffering, but for me to be able to communicate that to another person, it's impossible. I have this sense of having it grown up in me in little pieces and bits and pieces without me even knowing about it a lot of times over the last many years. But for somebody who hasn't even hardly started that path, don't you experience that as so much more difficult than working with that person?
Yes.
It's so flat for them. There's nothing. You just have to know that God loves them and that He's going to take them where He takes them. But right in this moment in time, maybe for these 10 years, all you can do is sit with them.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Because they don't really need an answer, because there is no answer. That's what we've been saying.
Right.
There really is no answer that kind of philosophically puts it all together, and so we stand back and go, oh, I get it, of course, God had to do it that way. We're not going to find that kind of answer. So what has to happen for us instead, if wisdom does not consist of a coherent philosophical answer, it consists of a certain kind of perception, a certain kind of enlightenment, where the light goes on and you go, okay, this is how I must face my life.
Ooh, now I really like those words, a certain kind of perspective, a certain kind of enlightenment, and a certain kind of intuition that's been built into us that helps us understand something far more than any words could ever describe it.
Right.
And we're struggling right now to even describe why suffering has meaning in our own lives.
Right, yeah.
I know when I'm sitting with somebody and they get it and I get it.
Right.
And I also know when I'm sitting with somebody and people are just slopping around in the mud and have no comprehension. They feel like they're going to suffocate in the water.
And probably they're fighting it. I mean, that seems like those are the only two alternatives, is we resist it. We resist seeing suffering for what it is, or we see it, but there's really no other option in the final analysis.
Well, there's two things that happen when we suffer. Either we suffer and we understand it, and we still experience the profound intensity of loss and sadness, or whatever emotion is appropriate with it. Or we suffer, we resist it, and we feel the intensity of our pain, and we're confused.
Yeah.
And so it is magnified
exactly.
For that person.
Yeah, exactly. Sort of what we're talking around gets captured, I think, in Romans 8. Starting with verse 16, he says, "The Spirit Himself bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God." That is, the issue in this context is who are and who are not children of God, and what's the ramifications of being a child of God. And if children, heirs also, that is, those who will inherit God's promises, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with Him, in order that we may also be glorified with Him. And what's really significant to me about that passage is that he's talking about a certain willingness to, and this is going to sound weird, but a certain willingness to embrace our suffering. Maybe that's too poetic language, and doesn't do justice to the suffering, but
no, I even hear that. I even hear that in secular psychology. I hear that. You stumbled onto something that's actually used a lot.
The word embrace.
Embrace our suffering.
I think that's what Paul is saying, is that if we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him, what do we find is the case with Christ? It talks about how he humbled himself even to the point of obedience to the death on the cross in order that he might be glorified. That is, he looked at the suffering that God prescribed for him, or that the role that God gave him was a role of suffering in this life. Humiliation, contempt, persecution, ultimately death, an agonizing death. Why was he willing to go through that? You know, why didn't he fight it? Why didn't he resist it? Why didn't he run from it? Why didn't he scream at God and say, God, why me? Don't make me go through this. He willingly, voluntarily took on the role that God had for him, but why did he do that? For the glory set before him, New Testament says.
With one piece, though, he did sweat blood up in the Garden of Gethsemane before the cross, and he said, you know, God, if you can do it any other way, let's work that out.
Right. Yeah, which indicates how clearly he was aware of and conscious of what a bummer of an experience it was going to be. I mean, this was not going to be fun. And he did not, you know, he didn't go into it casually. He didn't go into it cavalierly. He didn't go into it with some kind of insane, hilarious joy and delight of what faced him. He was so stressed out that he was
sweating, sobered by the reality of it. He was sobered by the reality.
He
embraced the suffering in the sense that he was going to take it on, but he did it willingly, but not without pain.
Right.
And I think that's a lot what we're taught sometimes, is if we are scared of it, or if we experience a lot of pain in it, or terrible discomfort, then we're not facing it well. And the reality is, even Jesus faced his pain with a great deal of discomfort, and yet he faced it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. Oftentimes we look at anxiety and stress as unbelief, but it can't be unbelief, because Jesus was about as believing as you can get, and it was a very stressful experience for him, a very filled with anxiety. And that's just a normal response to a realistic appraisal of what lay ahead for him. And so the point I was making is, why did he do that? For the glory set before him. And I think what Paul is doing is saying, one of the marks that we are children of God, who are going to inherit the promises that God has made to his children, one of the marks is that we have exactly that same sort of attitude. We take that same sort of attitude in our lives. That the suffering of this life, we are willing to undergo. We're willing to let God write the script of our lives, as horrendous as that may be sometimes. We're willing to say to him, I will suffer whatever I must suffer in order that I may lay hold of the glory that lies before me. You write the script, God, and I will live it. I just want what you want for me in the end, at the end of the road, in the final analysis, at the end of this age, in the kingdom to come. I want the glory that's there, so I will do whatever I must do in order to obey you here.
There's a whole lot of peace in that. Am I interrupting you? There's a tremendous amount of peace in finally relinquishing, in a sense, and embracing the suffering that comes to us. Nonetheless, again, I need to emphasize that it's still quite painful.
Yeah.
I think of some people I know that whose lives I share in, and they are in such horrendous pain. It's the kind of pain that someone might have had if they had been one of those twins that was experimented on in Auschwitz, that had the medical experiments, and they were completely tortured at a very young age and hurt. And I work with people who have had those kinds of experiences. And they say to me, isn't it bad that you're doing this with me? Doesn't it hurt your life? It must be wrong for you. It couldn't be that you should have to go through this with me. And, you know, I used to kind of think that. This is just too hard for me. This is just too much. But I don't feel that anymore. I don't think that anymore. I do suffer with it. It is very difficult. But it's right. It is a good thing for me to do. It is a thing that helps me understand people, understand God in a way that's inexplicable to me. But I need to join them in their suffering. That's clear to me. And it doesn't hurt me. It helps me. It's right for me. It's good for me in a way that I wouldn't have known 10 years ago, but I know that I know today.
Can you be a little bit more specific about it's good for you, why? What does it do? What does it accomplish?
It opens up my understanding. It helps me be more wise. It helps me see better. It helps me understand into the hearts of people. And I think that's a really good thing. It's what I want to do. In the same passage in Romans 8, I don't know if he's talking about this, but in verse 26, and this is Romans 8:26, and in the same way the Spirit also helps our weakness, for we do not know how to pray as we should, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. As I was listening to that in church actually yesterday, I was thinking, it isn't only that we don't know how to pray. It's not just that we don't know the words. It's that we don't know ourselves. We don't get the depth of our own groanings, and so the Spirit has to groan for us. And yet I'm in this position, Jack, where I get to hear the groanings, the depth of groanings of people who have had the courage to face into that and aren't just running away from life and hiding from life and scampering, but they're right in the midst of their groanings. And it's almost like I get to understand in part what the Spirit understands. And it's like a gift.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what about God? Do you get to know him better?
What I get to know about God better is that I have to ask myself the question, which I was talking about earlier, is God good?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm coming up against it all the time. In the midst of these Auschwitz experiences that these people have had, could God be good to have given that to them? And I don't even know how to explain it, but yeah. I keep on coming up with, yes, he is, he's good. And I keep on walking into a world that's bigger than what I understand. It's just, it's more than, it's like there's this universe out there that I get to share in and I get to see. And in that universe that I don't get, I do have to confront, is God good again? Yeah, he is.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not an easy question for me because I love these people and I really would have preferred that God had done it differently. But the suffering that he gave them, he gave me.
Mm-hmm. Vicariously, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And is God good that he gave that to me? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all very important because I think sometimes, at least I, earlier in my life, saw suffering as kind of a mechanical process. God puts me in a vice, and by squeezing me, makes me better or something. But that doesn't make any sense out of your experience then, because you're not being squeezed except vicariously by identifying with them. And what makes the most sense is suffering brings us to enlightenment by raising important questions that we have to decide how we're going to answer those for ourselves. And that can happen vicariously, it seems to me, by our identification with people and their sufferings. They become our sufferings. They become our questions.
If we take it on enough, if we're willing to enter into that enough.
Yeah. One of the things that in Deuteronomy, this is a passage that Jesus quotes in his temptations. Moses is talking to the nation of Israel and he talks about their experience and he says, God humbled you and fed you with manna that you might come to understand that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Now, for the longest time, I didn't understand what he was saying there because I've always assumed that the manna was sort of this just wonderful experience for Israel. And in a way, of course, it was. I mean, one aspect of what he was doing by feeding them with manna was guaranteeing their sustenance in a supernatural kind of way. They didn't have to worry about, would they find food? Would there be food available naturally, supernaturally? He was just constantly feeding them. And so that there was something wonderful about it in that sense. But on the other hand, what Moses says, he humbled them. and fed them manna. That is, he brought them to a state of deprivation, feeding them manna. He impoverished them, feeding them manna. And it finally dawned on me that as much as it was a supernatural feeding of God and in that sense a blessing, on the other hand, God could have used his same supernatural ability to give them a varied menu and to give them a banquet all the time. And that's precisely what he did not do. He gave them this bland, boring, uninteresting stuff that sustained their physical existence, but didn't do anything to delight them sensually.
And I think the opposite. It would have given them kind of a sense of emotional deprivation.
Flatness and emptiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And you see that because at one point they finally rise up and say, Moses, we want to go back to the pots of stew in Egypt. We want the leeks and onions in Egypt. This is getting just too much. Well, why? But what he says about that is he did that in order that you might understand that man does not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. That they had to make a choice. That generation fed in the wilderness had to make a choice. What do I want my existence to be all about? An interesting, varied diet or the inheritance that God has promised? And that's really basically the fundamental decision that every human being ultimately has to make. What do I want my life to be all about? The good and wonderful delights that I see around me in this created order? Do I want my life invested in those, in the pursuit of those, in the acquiring of those? Or do I want my life to be about the inheritance that God has promised me? If I choose the former, I'm not a child of God. If I choose the latter, then I'm a child of God. And what I'm saying is, God, deprive me of whatever you need to deprive me of in this life. Let me go without. Let me go hungry. Let me go naked. Let me be cold. Let me be unsheltered. But whatever, take me through whatever role you want me to do, but I just want the inheritance that you have promised me in the end.
Or let me add some things. It could also be for somebody who is wealthy. Let me live with that wealth.
Mm-hmm.
Help me to make that something that I understand about you, God. Help me deal with the particular issues. I think what you're saying is whatever issues that are brought into my life that are difficult to me, let me live with those.
Mm-hmm.
Let me live with those righteously.
Right, right.
And those things could be what many people would call good, like wealth. It could be something very difficult, like lack of health.
Right. I do think that he's talking about the value of and the place of some kind of suffering and deprivation. I think wealth, however, is a kind of deprivation because it robs me of a certain tranquility. It robs me of a certain simplicity in my life. It complicates my life.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm being deprived of that. By being given this one blessing, I'm being deprived of another one. And therefore has the same effect.
Absolutely.
You know, what am I going to do with being deprived of the simplicity and tranquility and peace in life? This chaos that has been created by this blessing, can I embrace that chaos and know that that's the lot that God has given me? So what I see him saying in Deuteronomy is what God ultimately wants to do through the suffering, in whatever form it takes, what God ultimately wants to do is raise the question, who are you? What do you want your life to be all about? How do you want to define your existence? Who am I exactly, Jack? How do you want to relate to me? It raises those huge, 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 big questions. And I'm going to answer them in one of two ways. I'm either going to answer them in keeping with what's true, in which case I demonstrate that I'm a child of God, or I'm going to answer them in my folly, in which case I demonstrate that I'm a child of the devil. But that's why God brings those into my life, as he did in the life of Israel. In order, what he wants to do is enlighten us. We may, through our own hardness of heart, decide to make the suffering and deprivation of my life my own destruction. But that's my choice. God didn't bring it into my life to destroy me. He brought it into my life to bring me enlightenment, to raise the questions that will make me wise.
And going back to the example that I brought up with people that I experience life with who have had Auschwitz experiences, I think very much I could have gone in the direction of hardening my heart and hating God because people have because I'm with people that suffer so much. And yet, God softened my heart. And rather than me going the direction away from God, I had to ask important questions, and I went in the direction of having a greater understanding of who God is, a greater softness toward Him. An awesome, I'm odd. I'm pretty sobered by who He is. I mean, He can decide to do anything He wants. Mm-hmm. And He does not promise for our lives to just be full of prosperity and to feel good. I think there's a whole lot of that out there that people are talking about. If you really love God, come to Jesus and you'll feel good. Certainly, that's how I came to Jesus. My life was going to get all better. Well, the reality is my life is all better, but certainly not the all better that I defined.
Yeah. Not how you envisioned it.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. And it seems to me that part of the wisdom that you have to come to be rightly related to all this is what really human existence is all about. Because as you counsel those people who have been deprived of so much that they never should have been deprived of, they have been robbed of it by the sin and evil and cruelty of other people, that never should have happened in an ideal world. The question you have to ask is, how important is that which has been robbed from them relative to the gift that God has in store for them in the final analysis? If we weigh those the same, then the goodness of God gets called into question, the purpose of life, the meaning of life. We just end up with a chaotic world that's absurd. If
the
other
glory
people's
isn't
choices,
more.
Yeah, if the glory is not more, and so what you finally have to settle for yourself is, as awful as this sounds to us under the sun, here where we live in this life, as awful as what they have gone through and experienced sounds, it's just trivial compared to the glorious reward that God has in store for them. And so you can't help but come to recognize the only way this world makes any sense is if God has something really incredibly wonderful in store for all of us.
It must be incredibly wonderful, because I believe what He says is true, and what He says is... I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. And, gosh, Jack, I have to say that's... I've really had to test out this verse, because, you know, early on I saw suffering as 10%, then 20%, then 50%, then 100%, then 10,000%. And I've had to kind of keep opening my blinders. Well, is this glory set before us better than 10,000% of suffering for someone who never stops suffering, from somebody who has to hold themselves back from killing themselves and killing others on a daily, moment-by-moment basis? Is the glory still better than that kind of suffering? Hmm. Huge question.
Yeah.
Huge question. And my answer keeps on being, yeah. And I seem to not be thrown off by people suffering. I'm a little bit concerned about my own suffering. I think even as I suffer with other people, if I was sent into a kind of situation where I saw a number of people that were very close to me murdered, then where would my faith be? I can't know today. I hope that it's where it is today, but I don't think any of us can know that.
Yeah.
I have a good idea. I've been trained to be able to do that, but I don't know for sure.
But I do think in that regard we do have an important promise that God has made. Through the Apostle Paul, he says there is no, it's often translated temptation, but it should be translated trial. There is no trial that has overtaken you but what is common to man, and God will through that trial make a way of escape that you might be able to endure it, something like that.
Well, that's pretty close.
Is that good? Okay.
Yeah.
We often miss the whole point of that because it gets translated temptation, I think wrongly in that context. And so we have turned it into a verse that says you really don't have to sin if you don't want to. But it's a much more profound promise than that. What Paul is saying is, just like the Israelites back in the time of Moses, who went through all kinds of trials of their faith, they fell away because of the hardness of their heart. But if we ask ourselves the question, but couldn't circumstances get so bad that I would fall away too, to which he's saying, look, everything that could happen to you has happened to people throughout the history of mankind. There isn't anything that's going to happen to you that hasn't happened to somebody. And if God was capable of keeping them and preserving them in their faith through what they went through, he can do it for you as well, and has every intention of doing that. If you are a child of God, you will not fall away. God will provide the way of escape.
Hmm. Well, that's really good to be reminded of, Jack. I like that. It's a great reminder.
It is, yeah.
I'm reminded of, I think I've shared this before here on the radio, but I'm reminded of Corrie ten Boom was talking about the horrendous things that were happening in the concentration camp for her during World War II, and she said something like, as she saw more and more evil, at the same time, corresponding to that, she saw more and more glory.
Hmm.
And that's kind of how I see life now, which is, it's really a paradox. As I see more and more suffering on the part of people that I work with in particular, God's glory seems to extend. I mean, not that it gets bigger, but my perception of it grows. As I see 10,000% of suffering, it seems like I see so much more than that of God's glory. It just doesn't seem like it seems like every time I see something hard, God's glory, the breadth of it gets bigger. Does it make any sense?
Yeah, it does. A lot of sense.
Who would have thunk? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the same is true when people hurt me, it seems like the worse they hurt me, initially I just get up in arms and just so mad about it. But where I settle pretty quickly is, as I see evil getting bigger and bigger, I see God's mercy bigger and bigger. So it seems that the worse things are, the more also that I want to forgive, the bigger that is, which also is quite a paradox to me. Now, not initially. Initially, I want to get back at very often. But when I look from a distance, when I have a little bit of time, my heart hurts for people who are full of evil.
That's the enlightenment that suffering brings. I think that the recognition of the greater, more expansive glory of God that God has in store for us as our inheritance, the need for mercy, the value of mercy, the beauty of mercy, the wonder of mercy becomes bigger and clearer and brighter to us. That's the sort of enlightenment that doesn't automatically come because of suffering, but it's what suffering is intended by God to bring. And as God also works in our heart, that's what will be produced in us by suffering.
Jack, I think I can hear a lot of people saying out there that I talk with that, wait a minute, is suffering the only way that God brings us to understand his mercy? Couldn't it be that we understand God's mercy through many other things, and that our faith grows through many other avenues? And aren't you guys just being kind of one-sided that you're talking about suffering here?
Well, it's hard to know how to answer that, because I, on the one hand, I'm tempted to say no, suffering is the only way, because both my experience and the emphasis of Scripture suggest to me that's just a major part of the process that God is taking us through. On the other hand, I don't want to deny that there aren't other inputs to that. The study of Scripture has been important to me. It's given me the concepts to be able to articulate these intuitions that God produced in me through suffering. So I wouldn't want to downplay the importance of that at all. I mean, my whole life is given to that, and I've given my life to that because I think it's probably the most important thing a person can do in this life, is understand God's revelation. So that plays a big, important role. The encouragement, the exhortation, the persuasion of other people, as they talk to me and as they remind me of what's true, that's important to this enlightenment as well.
I think also what's important is other people's loving me.
Yeah,
really,
absolutely.
Really loving me. And some churches, some pastors come from that perspective primarily. We have to understand the love of God before we can understand, I mean, the love of people, and then we understand the love of God, rather than from the perspective you and I come from often, that we have to understand suffering, and that helps us understand the mercy of God. They're two very different directions that we're coming from. And I think that we need to not be short-sighted and only play off one or the other. Because there's some people, Jack, who, when they hear suffering, they have been so wounded by it, so maliciously hurt, that suffering, it's like an automatic door. It just goes down right away. And what they need is to be really, really, really loved. And as they're loved, maybe they can open up to understanding that God's merciful, perhaps like the people who loved them. So we have to look at individuals and see where they can understand who God is. And that's really the ultimate goal, is to help them understand who God is. Ultimately, though, we are going to need to experience both. Certainly being loved by other people to understand God's mercy, and certainly if we share in God's glory, the sufferings of Christ, we also will suffer in the glory of Christ. We're also going to have to suffer and share in that. That's just what is. That's what the Scripture says very explicitly.
Right. Yeah.
Jack, I want to bring us back to something before our time ends. I'm hoping that I won't confuse the issue, but I'm afraid I may. So everybody put on our thinking caps here. We said earlier on in the show that the purpose of the book of Job was that to show that suffering isn't a result of our faithlessness. It isn't a result of something that we've done wrong. But wouldn't it be right, more right to say, Jack, that the sufferings, that there are sufferings that God brings into our life through all different kinds of means, through many outside influences, inside things, whatever, that those are sufferings that are the trials that help us ask the questions, who is God, what's important in my life, help us grow up, help give us insight, help give us perspective, help give us wisdom and understanding of who God is. That kind of suffering is a trial that brings us toward God. But Jack, we don't have those sufferings because of something we've done wrong. And there are other sufferings that we have because of what we've done wrong.
Right.
And yet they can still bring us to understanding God better in the same way that the first sufferings did.
Right.
So I think that can be kind of confusing, and I don't know if at any one time in our life we can know exactly what kind of suffering we're experiencing. I don't bring a flood into my life. I don't make the waters rise, and so there's obviously nothing I can do about that. But I do bring other suffering into my life, and I think that's in particular interpersonal suffering and intrapersonal suffering, what I experience inside myself and what I experience as a result of relating to other people.
Right.
I bring a lot of suffering into my life from that perspective, and I do very much need to take responsibility for that and not just say, well, God just did this, or I just wash my hands of my responsibility. It is, in fact, of incredible importance for me to accept responsibility, to see my part in how my actions and how my attitudes and how I am impacting the world around me.
Right. I think we even have to make a distinction between there's the external suffering that really is not in proportion to my sin. Then there's that intra and inter stuff that is a result of my sin. And there's another dimension to suffering, I think, that is a function of my unbelief and my rebellion. And that is when I not only am suffering deprivation or pain or anguish of some kind, but because I don't have the wisdom to understand why it's there and what God is doing and how I ought to submit to it, how I ought to embrace it, if I fight against it, then I'm actually amplifying the pain and the suffering that is there in a way that's completely unnecessary and a way that could be eliminated if I would simply, out of some kind of wisdom, submit to it and embrace the suffering and say, God, your will be done. There's a sort of, I think you called it earlier, a sort of peace that comes from knowing that this is all for a purpose, all in order to accomplish what God wants to accomplish, that is ultimately good and ultimately a blessing and ultimately a glorious inheritance.
But we all experience all of those sufferings across the
yeah.
board. I certainly have not gotten to the place where I can say, I just embrace suffering. I don't. I get to the place where eventually I do, but I have to go back 10 steps to get there,
mm-hmm.
almost every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Is that true for you?
I don't know about every single time, but often.
Most times. Yeah. Most times.
Yeah, sure. Our knee-jerk natural reaction is to fight it.
It is.
We don't want to have to do it.
And to create more.
Yeah.
So we definitely need to take responsibility for that.
Yeah.
I think what happened in Job's life was a lot of stuff that he had absolutely no control of. He just had one hurricane after the other hit him. And I think part of he had, though, that kind of suffering where he added to it by not embracing it,
mm-hmm.
and also by his friends, you know, giving him wrong information.
Right. On the other hand, you have David, who went through horrendous suffering because of his sin. His adultery with Bathsheba, the murder of Uriah, his attempt to kind of rationalize all that and hide it from God. And you have all those poignant psalms that he wrote talking about the turmoil inside of him as he tried to hide from himself and God his sin and couldn't do it. His bones melted within him, he says, and he couldn't sleep at night. I mean, that was tremendous suffering that he brought on himself. I think part of what you're getting at, though, is that all of that, no matter where it's coming from, one, we need to take responsibility for what we need to take responsibility for. That's true. On the other hand, we can also have the confidence that, as Paul says in Romans, the passage we've been looking at every now and then, all things work together for good to those who love God and are called according to his purpose. I think even the suffering that we bring on ourselves due to our disobedience and our rebellion and our sin, ultimately in God's providential authoring our lives, is ultimately going to work together toward my eventual wisdom and enlightenment and understanding of what's important and what life is all about.
And to that I have to say thank God.
Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I was talking to someone the other day about her daughter who's making some choices about her sexuality that are really, really destructive. And right when I was talking to her, it was kind of in the thinking stages for her daughter, thinking about what kind of sexual orientation does she want to have. And I said, you know, it's real possible that your daughter may go through a time where she's really going to fall here, where she's going to make some very bad choices, not just in her thinking, but in her behavior. And her daughter did do that. And I think that's actually true so much for us, is that we end up making very, very destructive choices. And I wasn't suggesting to this woman, by the way, that she should encourage her daughter to make bad choices. Quite the contrary, but to recognize that that's really a possibility for her daughter. And we just do that all the time. I mean, I look back on my life, Jack, and I just see wreckage of things that I've done, and yet, in spite of that, God has worked all the things together for good, which is quite amazing that he could shovel up all this manure and put it together in something mm-hmm. that has value.
Yeah, absolutely. But he does. I can remember reading a book, a rather abstruse and abstract and theoretical and scholarly academic book that brought me to tears.
Only you, Jack. Only you would be brought to tears by a book like that.
Well, it was a book by Jacques Ellul called The Meaning of the City. And what he does in the book is he traces the places where the city kind of is mentioned and plays any sort of role in the Bible. And the first city is built by Enoch. I mean, I'm sorry. The first city is built by Cain, who was the murderer of Abel. And he built the city after he was terrified that somehow the murder of Abel would be visited back on him and there would be vengeance done against him. And he's paranoid that his life is going to be taken. Well, God comes to Cain and says, relax, I put a mark on you to protect you. But Cain doesn't believe God, and he built a city for his own protection.
A fortress, a protection.
A fortress, yeah, it's a walled city to give him protection. And yet, and so the point that Alul makes throughout the entire book is that that's what you see the city represents, is an embodiment of evil, an embodiment of unbelief. And he goes so far as to argue, you know, that's why our urban social problems are so intractable, is because, in a way, the city is a monster that human beings have created, where we've poured all of our unbelief and evil into them, and they take on a life of their own that is just seething with our rebellion and our evil against God, and manifests itself in a lot of social problems. But then he comes to the end and talks about how, at the end of Revelation, what does God do in the end to take us into glory? We have a city. But it's a city that's not built with human hands. And the point that he makes is, God has not rejected the choice of human beings to live in a city. He ratifies our choice, the decision that we've made in our past, but he redeems it. You know, he takes the evil out of it and the ugliness out of it and gives it to us in a purified form. Well, he didn't make this point, but I just reflected on my own life and my own fears that I had at that time. And that was, I lived with this constant sense that what if I get to heaven and I look back on my life with nothing but regret for the choices that I had made? Because I realized how foolish some of my choices were, how capable I was at any moment of making another foolish choice, something that was destructive, something that was disobedient, was folly, was foolishness. And am I going to look at back on my life and go, oh, how good eternity could have been if I hadn't wrecked it by that stupid choice back then? And the relief that came over me when I recognized that isn't ever going to happen. That can't happen. Heaven is not filled with regret. Heaven is filled with joy. And why is it not filled with regret? Because God is going to take the very choices that I have made in my life and redeem them. That's what you reminded me of when you said he takes all this garbage that we give him.
I said manure.
You said, okay, he takes all this manure that we give him, and somehow he redeems it and gives it back to us as this precious, wonderful gift that we will find delightful. That's a very, very liberating truth, I think, to know that I can't, through one slip of my foolishness, wreck my entire existence.
And I can't even, through a million slips, wreck my eternal existence.
Right, exactly.
It can't be wrecked.
Yeah.
It's not possible.
If God is for us, then not even I can be against me.
Oh, that's very well said. Okay, 3 minutes to the end of this broadcast. Let's put it all together. Let's you put it all together, Jack.
Well, we got into suffering, the issue of suffering, because we were talking about trials and tribulations and the place of the role of trials and tribulations in my sanctification. The purpose of a trial is to test my heart in order that I can see my own heart. I don't know if we've actually made this point, but the point is that God doesn't need a trial to see into my heart. He can see directly into my heart, but I need a trial in order to be able to see my heart revealed to myself. You know, what makes me tick? What are my priorities? What are my values? What do I really want? What is my life invested in? As the circumstances of life come and put pressure on me, it pokes at me to test and see what I'm made of, where my investments lie, where my treasure is, as Jesus would put it.
And where I want my treasure to be.
And where I want my
treasure
to be. Not just
what's there.
Exactly.
But it helps me see where I want to go and what's there and what's before me.
And typically, it's suffering that God uses as the trial or the tribulation that really sorts me out, really probes and pushes and tests to see where I want my life to go. Why did God give us a universe where he uses suffering in that way? I don't know the answer to that. Nobody knows the answer to that. The Bible doesn't give us an answer to that, except to say, look, who knows better how to run this universe, you or God? God has demonstrated in so many ways he knows what he's doing, so relax and believe me that God knows what he's doing when he uses suffering. It's hard when we see how horrendous that suffering can be in some people's lives. It's hard to believe that could be true. But it's what the Bible is inviting us to believe, that even the horrendous tragic suffering that some people are called upon to endure, God knows what he's doing, and his purpose is to sort us out and to bring us wisdom and to bring us enlightenment, so that one day we will enter into a glory that will make all that suffering seem so trivial and so light by comparison that we'll brush it off and say, no matter.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
Well, just for a few minutes, I'd like to turn to you, the listeners, and talk to you directly. Last week, we had a board meeting with about six of us from Christianity at Work, and in walks one of our board members with reams and reams and reams and stacks of paper to give to each of us. And what they were was responses from you, our listeners, responses that we really sincerely appreciate. Some of them were letters that people have sent, and some of them were calls that people had made requesting tapes and making comments about how they felt about the program. And our board member asked us to just read through these and look at the responses and talk about what we want to do for the coming year. It was an overwhelming experience for me as I saw many, many people giving us positive reflections about this program. It was really heartwarming. We went around the room then, and the board member asked us, how do we feel about continuing? What do we think about it? And I have to tell you guys that I have an overwhelming sense of wanting to continue this program. I feel that we are in some unique ways able to reach into the lives of some people. One of the ways that I've really worked at doing that is to be honest about my own life. I think that it's such a tragedy that we go around talking about our lives as though we're really put together. That doesn't even fit our theology. Our theology is that we're sinners. We need to share our sinning. We need to share where we fail in order to encourage each other who also are failing and think they are alone. Not that we try to sin in order to share it, but that we just talk about honestly the reality of our lives. We want to request you, our listeners, to give to our program, to give financially to our program so we can continue our ministry.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, or would like to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The Mackenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the Mackenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The Mackenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to Mackenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKinsey Study Center, thank you for listening.